As I began this afternoon, I thought I would read to you just a brief story that is really, doesn't seem to be all that abnormal anymore. This is titled Good Old Human Nature, and I think you'll all appreciate what this means as we go through this. It's a very brief story. It says, a school teacher who had worked most of her life was intrigued by a great investment opportunity that promised unbelievable returns on her money. It was an activity, as the shrewd investor told her, that could double her retirement, maybe even triple her life savings, in just a few short years. Now, it sounds a lot like Bernie Madoff of a few years ago, doesn't it? If you remember those stories, I forget how many billions of dollars he squandered. I want to say 40 or 50 billion. And I think for those who got, you know, this is the way every Ponzi scheme works, by the way. Those who get in at the beginning do really well, and those who get in at the end end up losing everything. So almost sounds a little bit like that. After a couple of meetings to go over the complicated and elaborate business scheme, she was all too eager to turn over her life savings to the savvy swindler. When her investment disappeared a few months later, her dream was shattered and her hard-earned life savings were now gone. Then she decided to go to the Better Business Bureau for help. A little bit out of sequence there, I think. Why on earth didn't you come to us first? The official asked. Didn't you know about the Better Business Bureau and what our services entail? Oh, yes, I really did, said the older lady, barely now able to hold back her tears of disappointment. I've always known about you, but I didn't come to you because I was afraid you'd tell me not to do it. How many times has that happened to God's people throughout the years? You know, people think that this is just too good to be true, and what's that little voice, that little feeling that says, I'm going to do that? And there's lots of scams on the internet now. I'm sure all of you have seen those. I hope no one has been tempted by them or lost money by them. I actually know a couple of church brethren who have lost money by them. I think most of us are more in tune with what's going on. In fact, just in my email this morning, I got one of those Dear Sir letters from a lady who said she was 57 years old. She was dying of pancreatic cancer, and she had $1.9 million that she wanted help with giving to other widows and orphans. And if I was interested, would I please fill out this little form and email her back? Now, we've all gotten those, haven't we? But I'll tell you, about 3 years ago, I got one in my email that almost got me, because the email, I bank with Wells Fargo, and the email came across that morning as I was going through my email, and it was during that time, if you remember a few years ago, there was like, I think it was Chase and Citicorp and a few others had a security breach, and there were like 5 or 6 million records that had been taken. And so I opened the email. It said from Wells Fargo. I opened it, and you know, it looked completely legitimate. It had their logo. It had all the right language. It looked just like I would normally find the Wells Fargo page when I logged on to do my own online banking. And it said in the note, it says, we have had a recent security breach, and we need you to confirm your personal information in order to be sure that you are protected. And then it said, go immediately to your website and click here. And so I clicked on that, and up came the login page, just like I'd normally get on Wells Fargo. But I concluded later that it wouldn't have mattered what I put in that login. It would have taken me to the next page. And then I got to thinking before I did anything, now wait a minute. The bank already had my personal information. If they had lost something or if there was a breach, they'd be contacting me. And they'd want me to close accounts and rip up credit cards and so forth. And so I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to just call the local branch and see if something has happened. So I called and talked to the lady I normally deal with, and she says, oh, no. She goes, we've not had a problem. She goes, that's just a scam. So she asked me to go back and make a copy of my computer screen and bring that into it to her and give it to her. Now, I was that close of falling for a a document where I was going to give them personal information. And I think many of us have, because some of them look very, very legitimate. A few years ago, there was a major scam going around. It was called the Nigerian scam, and I'm sure everybody's heard of that. And it's the typical, I've got $5 million, I need help getting it out of the country. And originally what they wanted you to do was to fill out personal information, give them your name, address, your date of birth, your bank account number. And in some cases, they were actually able to go in through the help of a foreign bank and actually wire money from your account to them. But I think most of those security holes got fixed a number of years ago. But what has transpired recently is, if you respond to that and say that you're interested in helping, then what they will do is they'll send you a form and you'll give them information. And what they will come back and say, we need you to pay so-and-so $275 or $350 as a fee in order for them to release these funds. So it's not a lot of money, but if you're in Nigeria, and a dollar a day goes a long way, if they can get $350 or $275 from a number of people, they do quite well. So we're all familiar with those kind of what I would call human nature tests, where we can be subject to making the wrong decision. And as I said earlier, how many times have God's people, some of our own people, fallen for some of these scams? We're going to get ready to have another opportunity here soon with Obamacare, if you've read anything about that. Because from what I've read, this is now the scam artist haven, because they're going to be able to come out with all kinds of lookalike pages, and they're going to actually pull people in, and people are going to give them their personal information and personal identification and personal credit card numbers, date of birth, all that. And so we're going to have, no doubt, a period of time where there's going to be a lot of identity theft. But it's the world we live in. Let's look at one other example in terms of how our human nature sometimes draws us into doing things that maybe isn't quite right. I know all of us have had an opportunity over the years to, no doubt, know a number of people who've been in a relationship, maybe a relationship that is moving toward marriage, for example. And how often is it, maybe it's not too often, but how many times have we been, not necessarily involved, but we've been familiar with circumstances where maybe the two individuals aren't quite matched for each other, and either a parent or a good friend will say something to one of them about maybe you should reconsider, maybe you should slow down, maybe it's a pastor, maybe it's an elder in the church. And in some cases, those relationships are broken off. In the example of my wife, she was engaged about 3 or 4 years before I married her. And that was a situation with her. It was something that she felt she was pushed into. And her father, just with a couple of comments one day, made the lights go on. And she broke off that relationship. Fortunately for me, she broke off that relationship. But that happened about 4 years before we were married. But how many others, even with feedback, they get trapped emotionally, they get trapped by feelings, and they go forward with a relationship that maybe shouldn't have happened. Sometimes those work out great, and sometimes they have problems attached. And part of that subset is sometimes we have people who are baptized members of the church, and they'll get in a relationship with someone who has nothing to do with the church. And the argument always is, well, I can make this work. I can change that person's mind later on. And, you know, and oftentimes that really doesn't happen. It doesn't lead to where we hope it would go. You know, we live in a world that continually challenges us to use wisdom and godly judgment. We live in a world where if we're not alert, things can go wrong. We live in a world that requires us to be spiritually engaged on all fronts. And if we are not spiritually awake and ready, sometimes we do fall. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 10. In Matthew chapter 10. Christ makes a statement here that I've often thought about, and we're going to look at this a little bit this afternoon, but in Matthew chapter 10, and beginning in verse 16, he says, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves." Now, Christ had a way of using parables or language to get across a particular idea or thought. And here in this very short verse, we have wolf, sheep, serpents, doves. And we're going to look at this in more detail in a moment. But here we see a warning, an acknowledgement in some respects that Jesus Christ gave to us. He actually was giving it to his disciples at the time, but it's certainly applicable for all of us. In the New Authorized Standard Version, it says, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves." And so we're going to look at that a little bit this afternoon. We're going to actually look at the principle of being wise as serpents and being harmless as a dove. But before we begin, we're all in Matthew. What does Christ mean by sending us out in the middle of wolves? What is the context of that statement? Let's look at Matthew 10, verse 17. And let's look at the context of what we're told, or the context behind the statement in verse 16. And I'm going to read from the NIV. It says, "Be on your guard against men. They will hand you over to the local councils and flog you in their synagogues. Because of me," or we could say because of what I represent, and this is Christ talking, says, "you will be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles," or we would look at that and say, or to the people who are not converted, people who are not of God. Verse 19, "But when they arrest you, do not worry about what you will say or how to say it. At that time you will be given what to say. For it will not be you that is speaking, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you." So here we begin to see what the context is of this statement about going out in a world of wolves. And then dropping down to verse 21, continuing on, it says, "Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child. Children will rebel against their parents, and they will have them put to death. All men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end, he will be saved." Now here pictures a time which I don't think any of us have really seen the time that's pictured here. Maybe in the first century AD, this happened quite a bit. There was a lot of persecution on the early church. But by and large, over the centuries, except for maybe a brief period of time in history when there seems to be a black period as far as the church goes, a period there's not a lot of history recorded, maybe some of this really did occur. But I think as we read this particular part of Scripture, we're going to see in a moment that this is really talking about a time that is probably not too far off in the future. Verse 23, it says, "When you are persecuted in one place, flee to another. I tell you the truth that you will not finish going through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes." So here we see that little hint that Christ was using this as an example of talking about a time, the conditions, right before he returns to the earth. So the context, as we've just read through this, deals with persecution, deals with having to live in a world filled with people who are unconverted. In fact, Christ, Luke 10 tells us, you don't need to turn there, that we have the story of 70 individuals sent out two by two. And we really don't know what happened to those 70 individuals. The Bible doesn't tell us. They no doubt went out. They were probably raised up churches. Maybe some of the churches that Paul later went to, we don't know. But we're not told what happened to these groups. But in verse 23 of Matthew 10, we see that Christ is really referencing the age to come, and probably the age that most of us feel like that we're already there, a time of great turmoil in the world, a time of great trouble for Jacob, for the modern nations of Israel. And so we see that from this section that it's really dealing with the latter time, the time right before the return of Christ. Now turn with me over to Ephesians chapter 2. We'll look at another related comment by Paul. Ephesians chapter 2. And I'm going to stay with the NIV, but beginning in verse 1 of Ephesians chapter 2, it says, "As for you, you were dead in transgressions and in sins." So here Paul is going back and referring to the group that he was talking to here, the group that had only been brought into the church recently, but he's going back and reminding them of what they were before they were called. And so he says, "You were in your transgressions, you were dead, in which you used to live when you followed the ways." Of course, that refers to the way or a path or a course of the world. "And the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who now is at work in those who are disobedient." And then he goes on to say in verse 3, he says, "All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires and its thoughts. Like the rest," notice what Paul says here, at least in the NIV, the translation, it says, "like the rest, we were by nature." In other words, this was our normal pull, our normal thought process before God came in and called us. He says, "We were by nature objects of wrath." And so here we see a little bit more background in terms of what Christ was referring to in Matthew chapter 10 about the conditions of the world, the conditions of our society. So by way of analogy in Matthew 10, Christ is going to use the wolf as a way to personify the current world that we live in, the current world of man, unconverted man. I think all of us have no doubt seen some of the nature programs on television, whether it's on the Discovery Channel or one of the others, and we've no doubt have all seen how wolves hunt. I don't think we have that many wolves in this particular part of the country. I think there are probably a few, but I certainly know how coyotes hunt and how coyotes work. When I was growing up in this area, we didn't really have coyotes, but in the last 10, 15 years, we seem to have a plethora of them now. And so they're very cagey animals. They're very smart animals. And in my particular situation, I think I've mentioned this before, we have a number of cattle that we take care of and that we raise. And usually every year in the late fall, early winter, they all are calving. In fact, they just started about a week and a half ago. And so over the next 3 or 4 months, we'll have somewhere between 110 and 125 young calves. But what we have discovered over the last few years is that with coyotes, as I said, they're very smart and they're very cagey, and they're very hard to trap and they're very hard to kill. But they know when a cow is ready to drop her calf. And in our situation, we've got donkeys that run with the cattle. They're supposed to be a good friend of the herd, and they'll ward off most predators in that sense. They'll even ward off strange or stray dogs that come into the pasture. But unfortunately, the way the old cow works is that when she's ready to calve, she doesn't like to stay right in the middle of the rest of the cows. She likes to get off to an area by herself. And the donkeys, they typically stay with the rest of the herd. And so what has happened, and we notice we've discovered this, and other farmers in the area have also discovered this, is that coyotes have learned that when a cow is going to calve, and when she gets to that moment, she beds down, she lays down, they are typically waiting in the lurch, waiting in the shadows. And as soon as the calf is out and hits the ground, the calf is defenseless, the mother cow is defenseless. They're there in an instant, and they take the calf and they're gone. And this is the way coyotes hunt. They are prey of opportunity, or they are predators of opportunity in that sense. Certainly, they hunt turkeys and they hunt rabbits and they hunt, in some cases, they hunt baby deer. But they've learned over the last few years that, you know, cows are pretty easy prey, especially those little 80-pound calves that can't get up and walk and can't fend for themselves. So here we see that, going back to the analogy that Christ is using, he's using that wolf, not a coyote, but the wolf to represent a beast of prey. And certainly we don't live in wolves or among wolves, most of us don't. But he's using that analogy, or he's using the characteristic of a wolf to describe the society, a society that preys on weakness. And a wolf is known for its cunning and its fierceness. It takes no prisoners, so to speak. And so here we see this analogy that wolves hunt in packs, and a wolf is an aggressive animal. But he said that we are sheep sent out in and among wolves. And I have never raised sheep. I've been around other people who have raised them. But I know that sheep are weak and docile. In fact, a good friend of mine has about 4 or 5 sheep that he's constantly has in his little lot. And they are so docile and so weak that if they are injured or if something is attacking them, what they will do, rather than fight back, they'll just lie down, and a lot of times they'll just simply give up and die right on the spot. And so, again, we learn some of the characteristics that Christ wants us to get us, wants us to understand in the world around us by describing the world as a wolf, an aggressive animal, we as his people as sheep, unprotected, pretty much docile in that sense, and certainly in the presence of wolves, really don't have any defense in that sense. So the point of the analogy is that Christ wants us to understand that the world we live in as God's people is a world filled with spiritual danger. Certainly it also has physical danger, but it's the spiritual danger that we're going to focus on this afternoon, because that's the intent that Christ wanted us to learn from Matthew 10:16. That we live in a world that has a tremendous amount of spiritual danger. The Greek word that's translated wise refers to practical wisdom, prudence, skill, and discernment. And if you do a little bit of research about that word, it really fits with what Christ and the apostles wanted us to understand about being a person that can discern, about being a person who strives to have godly wisdom. The serpent, throughout the Bible, and certainly it was this way in the ancient world, was often looked at as a symbol of being wise. Now, also cunning. And we think back about the story in the Garden of Eden, we probably think mentally, well, the serpent was very cunning. And yes, he was. But in the ancient world, the serpent was also looked to have practical wisdom. How many of you love snakes? Not a single hand goes up. I know as a youngster growing up, we didn't really have poisonous snakes in the area, but we had lots of black snakes. And being on a farm, there was a time when we used to put lots of small square bales in the barn. Of course, nowadays that's all done by big tractors and round bales, and you have all the equipment. You don't do the work that we used to do. But we used to put up about 3,000 square bales every year and put those in the barn. And the bales will weigh about 50 or 60 pounds. They're tied with 2 strings around them so that you can lift them and move them and toss them around. And stacking them in the barn in the summertime and letting them lay there and feeding them out during the winter, we always had a problem with mice getting into the hay. And I don't know what it is about the strings that were on hay, but the mice used to love to cut the strings and chew those. And when they build their nest, they would line the nest with the string around the hay. So we would be in the barn loft going to get a load of hay out, reach down and pick up the bale by the strings and pull it, and everything come apart. Well, my grandfather thought that an easy way to fend off the mice was to put as many black snakes in the barn as he could find. And so as youngsters, we used to go and hunt for black snakes. And I was never afraid of a black snake. You know, they're not poisonous. By and large, if they see you, they scamper away. They want to get away. And even if you see one and he hasn't seen you yet, and that's very rare to happen, by the way, once they see you and if they sense that you're coming in any way in their direction, they're gone. And the only time I have ever seen a black snake become defensive is when they cannot slither away. And then they will curl up and they will try to strike at you. And it never fazed my grandfather. As soon as they struck, he would try to catch their head. But anyway, not to divert, we would always have about 8 or 10 snakes that we would catch over the summer and we would turn loose into the barn. And I remember as a youngster getting in the barn, playing in the hay, you always had the risk that you were going to find a black snake in the hay. But you know what? The black snake did a really great job on the mice. We still had a few problems, but by and large, they took care of the mice. But again, Christ is using the serpent here, that wisdom of the serpent, and the part that I want to focus on this afternoon is they are really wise about not putting up resistance, not encountering difficulty. They just simply move out of the way. They move on. They're gone. So therefore, what Christ wants us to understand when we talk about being wise as serpents, it's not that we're trying to be crafty or cheat someone out of something or cause someone to fall down, as we think back on the story in the Garden of Eden. But being wise as serpents refers to God's people's ability to get out of the way and just to move and not become confrontational. And so in this analogy that's used in Matthew 10, verse 16, we're to be wise by just not confronting the wolves. Get out of the way. Don't be seen. Don't be caught with them. And the Greek word that's translated harmless literally means unmixed or pure. It's the same word that's used to describe like pure silver or pure gold. And so to be harmless as doves simply expresses the need for God's people to be above both, or be above reproach in both our speech and in our conduct. And we see that a lot through Scripture, and certainly we understand that that works to our advantage in this world, is that we're to be above reproach. The dove is simply a non-threatening bird, represents a type of innocence, and that innocence God is wanting us to pick up on. So God's people are to have a level of purity and innocence, no longer being contaminated by the world. And so the lesson from Matthew 10:16 that Christ wants us to understand is that we are to use godly wisdom and discernment in dealing with the world, all the while avoiding to fall back into that course or that path that we walked in, that we once walked in, that Paul described in Ephesians chapter 2. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 25. In Matthew chapter 25, we're all familiar with this particular parable. And this parable is one that Christ used to describe the church. And it's also a parable that allows us to really spiritually think and do some self-searching in that sense and looking at our own lives to make sure that we are learning, that we are applying, being in the world but not of the world, being in the world as wise serpents and as harmless doves. Let's begin in verse 1 of Matthew 25, and I'm going to again stay with the NIV. It says, "At that time the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish, and 5 were wise." Now the same Greek word that's translated wise in Matthew 10, verse 16, wise as serpents, same exact Greek word is translated wise here. So there is a connection between being wise and awake as God's people and as wise as serpents going out into a world of wolves. What's interesting is that the word that's translated foolish, see, five were foolish, five were wise. The word translated foolish means to be dull in thought and morally lost. So when you look at the meanings, when you look at the meaning of the original words used, it kind of gives you an understanding of what Christ is trying to get across to us. So foolishness has the meaning that we would identify with as dull in thought and morally lost. And then two, to be blocked in thought, as in one who is considered stupid. The Greek word that's translated foolish is also the same word that we get the word moron from. Not to put anybody down, but I know we've all familiar with that term. So going on in verse 3, it says, the foolish ones, now the ones who were dull of thought, morally lost, says they took their lamps, but they did not take any oil with them. And the wise, again, we already talked about the meaning of the word wise, the Greek word, which means godly prudence, wisdom, discernment, judgment, godly judgment. It says the wise, however, took oil in jars along with their lamps. And in verse 5, the bridegroom was a long time in coming, and they all became drowsy and they fell asleep. Now it's interesting, isn't it, that all of them became drowsy. All of them fell asleep. And again, this is a spiritual lesson. So all of them were spiritually drowsy, spiritually asleep. Is that where we find ourselves today in God's church, as God's people? I don't think any of us would say, yes, I'm spiritually asleep. We don't think that way, do we? But yet this was a warning that Christ is giving to his church, is that there is coming a time when his people may be spiritually drowsy, spiritually asleep. When we look at the world around us today, do we have the same energy and enthusiasm for God's truth that we had 20 years ago? Most of us have been in the church 20 plus years, haven't we? How many have been in the church more than 20 years? How many have known and lived God's way of life more than 20 years? You know, almost every adult hand in here went up. How many of us can think back in those years of the 70s and 80s when Mr. Armstrong always said, we're in that gun lap? You know, only a short time. And when most of us thought at the time that we were really in the gun lap. For a human being, it seems like a long time, 40 or 50 years, doesn't it? But you know, to God, it's that quick. And so how much more quickly can I snap my finger? If this represents 50 years, how much more quickly do I have to do it to make 30 years, or can I slow it down to make 70 years? But from God's perspective, that's the time that we've been living in for the last 40 or 50 years. In eternity, it's not even as fast as a click of my fingers. And so here Christ is showing us that there's going to come a time when the church maybe becomes somewhat sleepy, that some fall asleep. Does this refer to a number of years ago? Or is this still applicable for all of us today? See, I think it's still applicable for God's people now. How many of us daily cry and sigh for the world that we live in? How many of us are angered by what goes on in the world around us? You know, how many of us look at what's going on now in Washington, D.C.? Are we functionally dead as a country? You know, John Adams said that the Constitution was only relevant if it was over people with godly character and godly morals. So is the Constitution outdated? Is this the form of government we're going to have for as long as God allows this nation to exist? I don't know. They sure can't get anything done now, can they? What's going to change to make that all of a sudden reverse course next week, a month from now, 2 years from now? Is it going to get better or is it going to get worse? So I look at it and I wonder, is this dysfunctional system have any hope of being repaired, or is it only going to get worse? And so if it's going to get worse, which I think it will, because, you know, human nature never really improves. You don't rewind human nature. It only keeps moving in the direction of getting worse, doesn't it? And so if what we're seeing today is something that looks broken and confused and at a complete impasse, what's going to change it going forward? And then how do you unwind all of the trillions of dollars that have been printed by not just the United States, by everybody? Since 2008, worldwide, since 2008, there is $30 trillion more in currency than there was 5 years ago. How is that ever going to be unwound? And so we sit here in Sabbath services, or I stand, we go about our normal activities during the week, and how many of us really are in tune to the conditions and the times that we live in? And does that make us get into our Bible more? Does it make us spend more time on our knees? Does it make us more energetic toward God's kingdom? Does it create a better prayer life? I mean, these are all questions that I can't answer for you. I have to answer for myself. Is it having the effect that it should have on us, where we sigh and cry for the kingdom of God? Let's carry on in Matthew 25, verse 6. It says, "At midnight the cry rang out, 'Here's the bridegroom, come out to meet him.' And then all the virgins woke up and they trimmed their lamps. And the foolish ones said to the wise," and remember, the foolish ones, those are the ones who had become dull of thought and morally lost. So they still had God's Spirit, but they were dull in thought. It says, "The foolish ones said to the wise, 'Give us some of your oil, our lamps are going out.' 'And no,' they replied, 'there may not be enough for both of us and you. Instead, you need to go out to those who sell oil and to buy some for yourselves.'" So if we look at this parable in the light of what Christ said to his disciples back in Matthew 10, that we were to be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves, the foolish that's portrayed here in this parable, the foolish had not developed the character and the righteousness that was necessary to meet the bridegroom. And that's the whole goal, by the way, of all of us in the church today, is that we're developing righteousness and character. The group that were considered foolish were not in a state of spiritual purity. They were not skilled in the ways of God. And so again, we all have to look at our own individual lives and ask, which group do we fit in? Because ultimately, they all were drowsy spiritually. Hopefully all of us are in the group of the ones that were wise. You see, all of us have the duty and responsibility to stay spiritually awake. We all have the responsibility to stay spiritually pure. In fact, there's a number of scriptures throughout the New Testament that talks about becoming holy and becoming pure, just like Christ is, just like God is. And so it's incumbent upon all of us that we remember the sense of urgency that maybe we had last year or 5 years ago, or if we've never had it, to develop it and realize maybe time is very short. I have no idea how long time is going to go on. I would have never thought it would have gone this long. But what if it's 10 more years or 15 more years? What if it's 6 months from now? And obviously things can't happen 6 months from now, but you understand the point is that at some point in time, things are going to really cave and the world is going to get thrown into a tremendous amount of turmoil. Let's turn over to Proverbs chapter 4. In Proverbs chapter 4, And we'll look at what Christ wants us to be mindful of as we live and work in a world that he pictures as wolves looking to devour us. But in Proverbs chapter 4 and beginning in verse 14, it says, "Do not enter the path of the wicked, and do not walk in the way of evil. Avoid it. Do not travel on it. Turn away from it and pass on." You see, that's the same analogy of the serpent or the black snake that I was relaying to you a moment ago. When they see or sense danger, they're gone. They don't hang around. They move on. And so here we are, in that sense, to do the same thing when we sense danger, when we sense that there is a path of wickedness that's near us, that we're to move on. We don't walk on it. We don't take that particular trail. Verse 16, "For they do not sleep," and this is talking about the world of the wicked. Christ referred to it as the world of wolves. It says, "For they do not sleep unless they have done evil, and their sleep is taken away unless they make someone fall." Verse 17, "For they eat the bread of wickedness." And this is, again, this is talking about a way of life, a way of that people think, a type of motivation that people find themselves under. "For they eat the bread of wickedness, and they drink the wine of violence." Two different ways of life, by the way, being contrasted here. The first one that we see here is that world that Christ referred to as being like a world of wolves. But notice verse 18, "But the path of the just," again, this path represents those who are seeking to do the will of God, those who are wise and skilled, those who are spiritually awake. He says, "But the path of the just is like the shining sun that shines ever brighter unto the perfect day." And again, that perfect day is the day that we all look forward to. The day that Christ returns, the day that we receive our reward. Verse 26, dropping down to 26. God encourages us to do the following. He says, "Ponder the path of your feet, and let all of your ways be established. Do not turn to the right or to the left. Remove your foot from evil." And so as that wise serpent, here we see the principle applied, is that we don't get stuck on this path of wickedness or this path of unrighteousness, and that we're to recognize that there is a path of danger and deception, and we flee from it. We move on. Let's move over to Romans chapter 13. In Romans chapter 13, beginning in verse 11, and again, this ties back to the parable that we read in Matthew 26. But Romans 13, beginning in verse 11, it says, "And do this, understanding the present time." So again, Paul wrote this or said this almost 2,000 years ago, but we're much closer to the present time, as he's referring to here, than he and God's people were at the first century A.D. But he says, "Do this, understanding the present time." So in other words, be aware of the time that we live in. And then he goes on to say, "The hour has come for you to wake from your slumber, because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed." Verse 13, "Let us behave decently, as in the daytime, not in fleshly pleasures and in drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousies." So here we're seeing a way of life and attitudes, all thrown into the same encouragement. Don't fall into this trap. Don't fall into this kind of existence. Verse 14, "But rather clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ, and do not think or do not dwell about how to gratify the desires of the sinful nature." And see, Paul told us back in Ephesians 2 that there was a time when we were all under the pulls of that nature. And that nature was to do wrath, that nature was to have destruction. So how would we apply this principle of being wise as a serpent but harmless as a dove? How do we encapsulate that direction that Christ gave us? Let's turn over to Ephesians chapter 5, because it's certainly something that we need to be wary of and practice daily. In fact, each one of us needs to be asking God daily to provide us with His direction and understanding, because that's the only way, as we read in Proverbs chapter 4, that we're going to be able to follow and to walk in His paths. But in Ephesians 5, beginning in verse 15, it says, "Be very careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise." And so here we see that same Greek word again, being morally and spiritually awake, being prudent, using godly wisdom and godly discernment. Verse 16, "Making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil." Again, this pictures a time that I believe we're all living in today. Verse 17, "Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what God's will is in all things." How do we know what God's will is? Where do we turn to know what God's will is? John 17, 17. I'm not going to turn there. You can put it in your notes. But John 17, 17 says to sanctify, that we are sanctified by the truth, or we're purified by the truth. And he says that his word is truth. Let's look at what David said, or what David, in one of his prayers, Psalm 25. Psalm 25. Beginning in verse 4, "Show me your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths." So this is a prayer that David prayed daily. Verse 5, "Lead me in your truth." And again, we just referenced John 17, 17. Thy word, the Bible, what we have on our laps, that is the truth. "So lead me in your truth and teach me," David says. "For you are the God of my salvation, and on you I wait all of the days." So David knew where the direction came from. And David knew that if he was to be successful in having godly wisdom, godly prudence, being as wise as a serpent, having the attitude, the mind, the character of God, he had to ask for it. And God expects all of us to do the same. Let's turn back to 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy. Second Timothy chapter 4 and beginning in verse 2. 2 Timothy 4 beginning in verse 2. And I'm going to stay with the NIV. And here we see a section of scripture that Paul is really instructing Timothy as it relates to his young ministry being established, and Paul wanting to encourage him and what to really focus on and what to be cognizant of. Same instruction applies for us as individuals. Don't think of it as something that God is just giving to the ministry, applicable for all of God's people. But in beginning in verse 2 of 2 Timothy 4, it says, "Preach the word." And again, we might say, all of us may look at this and say, drink or eat of that word daily. But here we see Paul's instruction to Timothy, "Preach the word, be prepared in season and out of season, correct, rebuke, and encourage with great patience and careful instruction." Then he goes on to say in verse 3, he says, "For the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine." And so there's going to come a time when even those who may be wise can be fooled or trip over unsound doctrine. So a time is coming when men will not put up with sound doctrine, but instead they will look to their own desires. They will gather around them a great number of teachers and say what their itching ears want to hear. and they will turn their ears away from the truth, and they will turn aside to myths. And again, the spiritual essence of living and working and dwelling in a world that is really controlled by Satan is to never allow him to somehow get us to walk on that path of wickedness that we read about in Proverbs 4. So Paul's encouraging Timothy, again, encouraging all of us, walk the straight path, don't be led astray. Let's turn back a couple of books to 1 Peter chapter 1. Beginning in verse 13, 1 Peter 1, beginning in verse 13, says, therefore, prepare your minds for action. The New Living Translation translates that to think clearly. So here's something that goes on in our minds that we have to be completely cognizant of. It says, prepare your minds for action, or to think clearly. Be self-controlled. Set your hope fully on the grace to be given you when Christ is revealed. Verse 14, as obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires that you had when you lived in ignorance. Again, referencing back to what we read in Ephesians chapter 2. Verse 15, but just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. And again, we see this command throughout a number of scriptures. I only selected one this afternoon. But we see the theme that God wants us to all grasp hold of, which is to become pure and to become holy. And he goes on in verse 16, he says, for it is written, be holy because I am holy. And so here we see that God wants us to focus on being spiritually awake, spiritually astute, living in a world that wants nothing more than to see us crash and burn. Let's turn back to James chapter 4. In Proverbs 4, we saw that two ways of life, the two walks, contrasted in that sense, one being the path of wickedness, one being the path of righteousness. But I want you to notice a scripture that, or a statement that James makes here, which is, I think, extremely important for all of us. One verse, James 4, and begin and in verse 8. James 4, and in verse 8. It says, come near to God, and he will come near to you. Wash your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you who are double-minded. Double-minded simply means someone who is stuck between two opinions. Someone who clearly hasn't made a choice to either walk the path of wickedness, walk the path of righteousness. Somebody who is still pulled between two ways of thinking. The way that God thinks and the way that Satan thinks. And so here James says, purify your hearts. You see, it begins in our mind. It begins with a dedication to ask God to clean us, to teach us, and to purify us. And so James is encouraging us to don't be fooled. Understand the two paths and don't get sucked in to a world that seems to be wonderful and pleasant and exciting, the one that Satan puts out in front of us. I had the opportunity to, as I said earlier, to attend the feast in Park City. And I know some have been there. How many have been to Park City? I know there's a few that's been there. Okay, good. You know, Park City is also where the Sundance Festival is held. And right at the beginning of the feast, we had an opportunity to go out and do a number of us, and we're on a progressive dinner. I think there was five couples. And the guy that was taking us around Park City, we had a chance to experience different foods and different beverages in Park City. But Park City is essentially one long street, starts up at a knoll and kind of works down to a lower area. And we started at the top and simply made our journey down the main street in Park City. And about halfway through the evening, I asked the lady that was our tour guide, I said, I know the Sundance Festival is here, and I think it's in February every year, and I believe it lasts for about 2 weeks or so. And I said, how do they put the festival on here? What takes place? And she said, well, first of all, the city goes up by 20-fold. So when we were there in September, I think she said that that time of year, the population in Park City is about 5,000 people. During Sundance Festival, it grows to 100,000 people. And the main street of Park City is completely blocked off. And the street that we were walking up and down and cars were driving up and down is completely blocked off. And she said that it's basically shoulder to shoulder for the entire length of that street, 100,000 people, for a two-week period. And I asked her, the obvious next question is, well, where is the festival? Where do they put the Sundance Festival on? And she goes, right here in Park City. I said, where in Park City? Right here in downtown. And, you know, that I was puzzled for a moment because most of the Main Street, it's a little bit of retail, but it's restaurants and a few little shops. I said, where do all these people go to watch movies? And she said, oh, you won't believe it. She said about 2 weeks before the festival begins, she made this term, she said, Hollywood comes out and they take over the town. And all the restaurants and the shops lease out their facilities for that 2 or 3 week period. And she said they completely transform Park City to look like Hollywood. So they put up all these false facades on the buildings. And, of course, inside the restaurants, all the tables go out. And so they have various places along the Main Street that when I was there, you just simply walk in and have a meal. Those are all turned into viewing areas. And when you're walking up and down Main Street, the facade of the town completely changes. And it looks like it's a completely different world. And I thought, okay, that makes sense because when I've seen pictures of Sundance Festival, it looked to me like it was a specific area where all kinds of movie theaters were set up. But it's downtown Park City. And when she was explaining that to me and I was walking around and looking at it, it made me realize that that's really how Satan captures all of us, is that he puts up these facades that once you walk into that through that door, you're thinking you're walking into something great and wonderful. In the case of Sundance, you're walking into a movie theater. But in reality, you come back 3 weeks later, you're walking into a restaurant or into a bar. And so that's the way I think Satan captures most of the world. He makes it look and appear as though it's something that it's not. It looks attractive and wonderful, and as soon as you walk through the door, you find destruction and misery and all kinds of other problems. And you know, Satan hasn't changed. He uses the same attitudes. He feasts on the same weaknesses that we have, that Eve had. The only difference now is that the tools are different. There was no internet with Eve. But look at the tools that Satan has today. And so he's able to really capture a lot of people through that. And so here James tells us, don't be double-minded. Realize that way of life, Satan's way of life, only ends up in destruction. In fact, God said if this time wasn't cut short, all of you can fill in the blanks, there would be no flesh saved alive. It's hard to believe that man would be that deceived, that he would just simply not only destroy himself, but it says all flesh, all breathing flesh, so all animals, including human beings, gone unless God intervened. There's an old Indian parable that demonstrates what James was trying to get across in James 4. And the parable is titled, The Two Wolves. The Two Wolves. An old Cherokee Indian wanted to teach his grandson about two walks of life and began to tell him a story about two wolves. The old Indian begins to speak of two wolves that lived within him, and that they were always fighting. These two wolves are at each other's throat daily, and they carry on a tremendous fight day in and day out. He tells the young lad that one wolf is evil and full of anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-centeredness, pity, full of lies, false pride, superiority, and a huge ego. The other wolf, however, he's good. He's full of joy and peace, love, hope, humility, kindness, empathy, generosity, filled with truth. He has compassion and he has faith. And the old Cherokee Indian, he stops telling the story and he begins to gaze as though deep in thought. And the young lad, eager to find out more, looks up at his grandfather with a puzzlement on his face. And after thinking for a moment, he says, "Grandfather, which wolf wins the fight?" And the old Cherokee Indian looked down at his grandson and simply replied, "The one I choose to feed." You know, we all have that struggle, don't we? We struggle between having God's nature and Satan wanting to fill us with his nature. Well, as we conclude this afternoon, let's turn back to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. Beginning in verse 12 of Philippians chapter 2, he says, "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you both to will and to do his good pleasure." Verse 14, "Do all of these things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless children of God, who are without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation." And notice what Paul says here, "among whom," this perverse generation, "among whom that you will shine as lights of the world." And then he says, "hold fast to the word of life." And that's what we're all tasked with, is to shine as lights in a perverse generation. So hopefully all of us are awake to the conditions of the world that we live in and the world that we struggle in. I know all of us from time to time go through trials. I know there's a number here that have gone through trials, and God's people throughout the world, we seem to be going in and out of trials, whether it's work, whether it's health, family issues, employment issues. There's always a struggle. God certainly is stirring us up. Hopefully he's stirring us up to complete the race. But he tells us that we are to become pure and holy and filled with his righteousness. So let's ask God to teach us and to show us, to have his wisdom as well as his discernment. And through God's help, and only through God's help, are we to become as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves.